Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
It is the government's plan to move forward with a request for Parliament for extension and expansion.
Next week, the Harper government will move a motion to continue the mission against ISIS past its April deadline. How long will our troops be committed to this mission, and what exactly does expansion mean? We ask those questions to the Parliamentary Secretary to Defense, James Bazan.
McLean's has learned the Harper government will soon introduce new legislation to get rid of statutory release for some offenses, meaning some criminals could be kept in jail longer. McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with opponents and supporters of the planned changes.
It's not easy being green, but Green Party leader Elizabeth May has high hopes for the next election, believing her party may hold the balance of power after the next vote. She joins us to discuss her election chances.
The McLean's panel brings you an update on the investigation into the actions of the RCMP and Parliament Hill security during the October 22nd terror attack, and it discusses the latest on the two MPs accused of misconduct against two New Democrats.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Next week, it is the government's plan to move forward with a request for Parliament for extension and expansion of the mission. And I will obviously give more details when we do that.
That's Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who on Wednesday announced he plans to continue the mission against the extremist group known as ISIS. The deadline for the original mission is April 7th, but in just days, the government will introduce a motion to keep it going.
Harper wouldn't give many details about the government's plans, but when asked if expansion meant heading into Syria, the PM didn't rule it out.
I will address those issues next week. Let me just say the current authorization laid open the possibility of going to Syria, although we have not done that. But we'll address issues like that next week when I make a proposal to the House of Commons.
Days later, the military gave an update on the mission, saying so far our fighter jets have taken part in 53 airstrikes and more than 400 sorties. Since the friendly fire death of Sergeant Andrew Doiron, our troops have not been involved in any incidents of gunfire. Captain Paul Forget largely refused to discuss the possibility of expanding the mission, saying until it has been approved by the government, it is just speculation. But he does add that our troops will be ready.
Once a decision is taken and there is an expanded mandate, we're prepared to support the expansion of that mandate if that's what comes to bear.
So to speak more about the government's motion, I'm joined now by James Bazan, the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Defense. What day will the government be putting forward this motion to extend and expand the mission against ISIS?
It'll be early next week as to the parliamentary process as to giving notice of motion and everything. I'm not 100% sure exactly what day that the motion will be tabled and then brought forward for debate.
But the notice of motion should be put forward Monday?
And again, I would think it would be, but I'm not 100% sure. But I think you'd see notice on Monday and tabling whatever the time frame is after that.
What exactly does expand mean?
Well, it could be a number of things. It could be expand the time frame. It can be expand the number of sorties we're flying, and it can expand the training mission as well. So, you know, it has a number of implications, but at the same time, I'm not aware of exactly what Cabinet has approved as what's going to be in the motion. But I can tell you that we do believe that our Canadian Armed Forces, whether it's through the Air Task Force situated in Kuwait, or our Special Operating Forces who are in the Kurdish region of Iraq, have done great work and are really helping to not only contain ISIL and their genocidal activities, but we are seeing progress being made with the fight on the ground, with territory being taken back.
On the issue of Syria, it was an option in the original motion that was put forward to the House of Commons. Will we see something different in this? Will the Canadian military begin to either fly airstrikes in Syria or have some of our advisors cross the border?
Well, we know that the current motion provided that possibility. And as we're witnessing from our coalition partners, that ISIL is reestablishing itself in the region of eastern Syria and taking a lot of their heavy equipment there, and believing that it is safer and can be protected from the coalition. But let's be clear. You know, a lot of people think that if we decide to start flying sorties in collaboration with the Americans and other coalition partners, that we're supporting the Assad regime, and that's not the case at all. We, at no way, shape, or form, support this individual and his government. He's not a partner in the fight against ISIL. He's a state sponsor of terrorism. He's an individual that used chemical weapons on his own people. And, you know, we support the people of Syria and their struggle against the Assad regime in trying to achieve a democratic and free society. But that, unfortunately, the people of Syria are crowded between, you know, the death cult of ISIL and a barbaric regime led by Assad.
It certainly sounds, though, by your language and the language we've heard from the government, that that the plan is to join our allies in the coalition in their airstrikes in Syria to target ISIS. Is that where we're heading? Is that what the motion intends to do?
Look, we will discuss the exact details of that motion next week. I don't want to be at all hypothetical about what could be in the motion. So, you know, we have concerns about what's happening in Syria. We support our coalition partners who are currently engaged in the fight against ISIL in Syria. We will look at our options next week as to how Canada continues on in the battle against this terrorist organization.
In that original motion, when Syria was an option, I believe the motion said there needed to be approval from the government. Has our government been in contact with the Syrian government? I know you mentioned that there was no support for the Assad regime, but have we contacted them in regards to any military issues?
Again, we're not at all a partner in the fight against ISIL with Syria. So authorizations will come via coalition partners, the way the Americans and Jordan and other air forces are conducting themselves. If that's the decision that Parliament and ultimately the government makes, is that is how we would fight ISIL in a broader context than just Iraq. But I can tell you that, you know, the Assad regime, in their ongoing support for terrorism around the world, including Hezbollah and getting support from Iran and Russia, is not an entity that we plan on cooperating with.
So if it is the intention of the government the House of Commons with this motion to move into Syria, you're saying that this government and our military commanders wouldn't have direct involvement with the Assad regime? We do so by using our allies as a middleman, if you will?
And again, we'll have that discussion next week if this is a decision made by the government. If that's in the motion brought forward by the Prime Minister, then we'll have that discussion next week on how the mechanics would work. But I don't believe that any of the coalition partners have upfront relationships with the Assad regime, and, you know, have ultimately hoped that we would have some UN leadership on dealing with the civil war that's been going on for 4 years, and we haven't seen it.
Does expanding the mission include expanding the mandate of our soldiers on the ground? They're currently there in a non-combat role. Will they remain there in a non-combat role, or may that change?
I think the Minister of Defense, Jason Kenney, has been quite clear on this, is that we're happy with our Special Operations Forces, with the jobs that they're doing. and that we are there to not only, and everybody always thinks it's just a training mission, but it's there to help with command and control, to oversee operations. It's aid and assist. The assisting is to help oversee those operations, and that's why we find ourselves often in close proximity to where some of the fighting is taking place or where ISIL is present. But these are some of the best trained soldiers in the world, and I think all of us are very proud of the members of the Canadian Armed Forces who participate in this dangerous work.
So is that ruling out any possible combat role on the ground?
Let's see what the motion says next week. But I, you know, we don't have the numbers there. We don't even have a full company strength. It's a couple of battalions that we've sent over so far. They don't have the equipment to be involved in combat. All they have is equipment to defend themselves. And you know, I think most Canadians would be surprised if it wouldn't be on that.
Would the ground troops possibly go to Syria as well, or just airstrikes?
Well, I think right now we're quite satisfied with how the mission has played out in the Kurdish region, and working with our security partners there. Of course, we're incredibly saddened by the friendly fire accident that took Sergeant Boudron. So that investigation is taking place now, and we look forward to the results of the multiple investigations into how that friendly fire accident happened, and ensure it doesn't happen again.
How long are you looking to extend this mission? The original mandate was 6 months. What is the extension going to look like?
So the extension will be in the motion as well, and you know, I don't want to allude to any possibilities there, but just to put things in perspective, when you know, there's different time frames used when we made the decision to go to Libya, when we had our troops in Afghanistan, we saw, you know, from everywhere from 3 months to 6 months up to a year plus. So there is options on the table, and we'll have that discussion next week.
If it is a six-month extension, like it was with the first deployment, that would put us smack dab in the middle of an election campaign. So will it be timed to avoid this deployment ending in an election campaign?
And I think that's one of the things that, you know, has been taken into consideration, is that, you know, we will be, the writ would have been dropped, Parliament will be prorogued, do we want to go through the difficulty of having an emergency session of Parliament in the middle of an election cycle? And that is definitely something, and that's why, you know, there is discussion, is the mission going to be shorter, is it going to be longer in this motion, but that's something we'll discover next week.
Either way, though, whether it's shorter or longer, is it prudent to make sure that it doesn't fall in the middle of an election campaign?
There's times when Parliament has had to come back when they have been prorogued because of an election. But, you know, and we see it from time to time at the provincial level, but I would hope that we can avoid it. Personally, I would hope that we could avoid having the cost of firing up Parliament in the middle of an election for a 1 or 2 day debate.
How do you assure that this doesn't end up like a Libya or even an Afghanistan in a way where you have instability? How do you assure that that won't happen this time as well?
I don't think you can ever assure it. All you can do is work from lessons learned. You deal with the humanitarian crisis as best as we can. Canada, on behalf of the Canadian taxpayers, have been extremely generous and charitable in assisting all sorts of relief agencies, including the United Nations, in dealing with the crisis. But we are going to work closely, as we already have, with the Iraqi government to ensure that they can deal with the sectarian differences in the region, that they can become more secular in how they govern, and ultimately put in place the proper reforms to ensure that good governance and hopefully democracy and jurisprudence is adopted in the long term. But that is going to be, you know, after the fact. We're starting to see some cooperation on that level now. But first and foremost, let's make sure that we stop ISIL and make sure that they don't have the capabilities to continue to spread their terror in the region.
That was James Bazan, the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Defense, discussing the government's plan to extend and expand the mission against ISIS. You're listening to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
The Conservatives have been bolstering their law and order platform again lately. Over the years, the Harper government has imposed a raft of mandatory minimum penalties, and recently, Justice Minister Peter McKay tabled what he's calling the Life Means Life Act. It ends eligibility for parole at 25 years for murderers serving life sentences for the worst sorts of homicides, like those involving kidnapping or sexual assault. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes has heard there's more to come in this vein. John, what exactly have you learned?
Yeah, Cormac, sources are telling me that the government is very close to tabling, maybe as early as this coming week, a bill changing what's called statutory release. The way it works now is that offenders get out of prison, with some conditions attached, after they've served two-thirds of their sentence. The government's about to end that automatic release for repeat violent offenders. Under the new rule, they probably won't get out until the last 6 months of their sentence. It's an idea that's been kicking around in Tory circles seriously since 2007, and the Prime Minister's office confirmed early last month that legislation is coming. I'm told that's now imminent, so I called a couple of key people to talk about it. First, let's hear from Sharon Rosenfeld. She's co-founder and president of a group called Victims of Violence. You might know this, Cormac, but Rosenfeld is already very influential in conservative circles, and her claim is that some criminals see statutory release as a reason to scoff at any work towards rehabilitation while they're behind bars. Here's what she told me.
It seems to be the same people over and over again, and they know, I mean, these people are very, very criminally smart. They're not dumb by any means, and they know the system, they know how it works, and what we were told in many cases that a number of these individuals, say somebody is sentenced to 9 years,
right?
Well, they can automatically apply at one-third of their sentence, which is at 3 years,
right.
And if they so do not want to take any prison programs, or they really just don't care, then they will bypass the whole parole system at 3 years, and they just wait until their stat release comes up at two-thirds, which is 6 years, and therefore they refuse to take any type of programs, and if they're made to, like, they just sit there, they fall asleep. We actually went through some of the prisons, and there were some that were sleeping, and, you know, like, where does it all end in relation to public safety? I do understand what criminologists are saying. I do understand what they're saying in relation to it's better if CSC has some type of monitoring on them during the last two-thirds of their sentence, or the last one-third of their sentence. But a number of these individuals really don't care. And, you know, rehabilitation can only go so far as the individual is prepared to take the programs. And trust me, there are quite a large number of individuals who are incarcerated that do respond to rehabilitation, and they take programs. And there's been a lot of really good success stories, too. But the problem is the group of, or the classification of the repeat offenders. They are the ones that are causing havoc within the criminal justice system, and there must be a stop to it.
So that's Sharon Rosenfeld of Victims of Violence. But Cormac, you might have heard her there alluding to criminologists who think it's better to release offenders well before their prison terms are up, with conditions. One of the big names in this field is Anthony Dube. He's an emeritus professor of criminology at University of Toronto. I called Professor Dube to hear the argument in favor of keeping statutory release after offenders have served two-thirds of their sentences. I started out by asking him if there isn't a legitimate concern about criminals getting out of jail who are just too likely to quickly commit new crimes. Here's Anthony Dube.
I think you have to answer that question in the context of fixed sentences, which is that most of the people who go to penitentiary are eventually going to get out so that the sentence ends. Therefore, what you have to do is to figure out when the best time to let somebody out is. And in terms of reintegrating them into society and trying to get them to be peaceful, law-abiding members of society, the evidence and belief is that what you need to do is have some form of gradual release rather than letting people out cold.
Can you explain what, sorry to interrupt, but can you explain what gradual release is? I take it a period where they're under some kind of supervision, eh?
The circumstances at the moment is that for the most part, a sentence can be divided into three parts. The first part is that the person spends that time in prison. The second part, from the one-third point of the sentence to the two-thirds point, there's a possibility, a remote possibility, it turns out, that the person be released on parole. That means that there's a positive decision by the Parole Board of Canada that this person is not likely to commit another offense before the end of the sentence and would benefit from being released. And the third of the sentence, the person is, with a very relatively few exceptions, automatically released at the two-thirds point on supervision. They may have to live in a halfway house. They would have various conditions put on them. But the idea is that those conditions and the support that's given by Correctional Service of Canada will help that person become reintegrated into society. Now, if they screw up during that last third, they can be brought back for violating a condition.
Right.
So they don't have to wait until the person has actually committed an offense. So I think the idea behind this is, you know, really starts from the very simple fact that if you have a fixed sentence, you're going to get out.
Yes.
And that, you know, that's in a sense what's staring everybody in the face.
Well, John, that's an interesting clash of viewpoints there.
Yeah, it's a familiar one, don't you think? One side says, make the system tougher on criminals and we'll all be safer. The other says, no, what makes us safer is if the system actually turns people away from crime.
We'll definitely be watching for that legislation. Thanks very much, John Geddes, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief.
Still to come on the show, Green Party leader Elizabeth May hopes her party will make some gains in the next election. We also have the McLean's panel discussing the latest news on the investigation into the actions of the RCMP and Prominent Hill security during the October 22nd terror attack.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel gets an update on the investigation into RCMP officers and Parliament Hill security during the Ottawa terror attack, and the panel weighs in on the misconduct controversy for two MPs who have now announced they will not be returning to the Liberal caucus after an independent investigation. But first,
in the lead-up to the next election, the Green Party has some high hopes. Recent polling has shown on average the Greens have a 3-point boost in support from the 2011 election. Leader Elizabeth May believes when the people head to the polls in October, her party stands to gain, and that could put the Greens in a key position in the next sitting of Parliament. To speak more about her party's chances and a few other issues, I'm joined on the phone by Green Party leader Elizabeth May. So Elizabeth, if the Green Party hopes to be the balance of power in the next Parliament, you know, how many seats do you think you need to win to get to that point? How many seats is the Green Party looking at as a realistic goal in the next election?
Well, I mean, the question of balance of power is a little bit different than how many we hope to win, because the Greens in Australia held the balance of power the election before last and actually determined which one of the parties that fell short of a majority, but obviously had a lot more seats than the Greens. The one seat held by Adam Bandt in Melbourne was enough to determine that the Greens got to say, well, okay, it's going to be Julia Gillard, it's not going to be Tony Abbott. So in theory, one seat is enough to hold the balance of power, but obviously we hope to have far more than one seat. So goals being goals and where we're strong and what's realistic. Certainly more than 12 is my hope, because that takes us above the level that lets us sit on committees and participate fully in question period and so on. But the other thing about it, of course, is since we don't know how the math is going to break down, most pundits and, not that you can count on these things, but I think it's shaping up to be a minority parliament. And in a minority parliament, the more seats the Greens have, the greater the likelihood that we can force the kind of alliance and cooperation with the NDP and the Liberals that has so far fallen through in Harper's previous minority parliaments in 06 and 08.
It looks like we're going to have another vote on Canada's mission in Iraq and against ISIS next week. You voted against the last vote that came before the House on this.
Yeah.
I imagine you'll vote against it this time. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, I do think it's worth looking at whatever Stephen Harper is going to put forward as a plan. But I can't imagine, frankly, a hypothetical in which the Green Party would support the kind of military action that Stephen Harper has yet engaged in. That's not to say that we weren't in favor of reacting and doing something to shut down ISIS. We're very strongly in favor of measures that we believe will have more success than the approach that Stephen Harper has advocated so far.
Would you support any kind of military intervention, any kind of aggressive action against ISIS?
Well, yes, in the sense that we have to shut down its supply of money, and that could involve taking out refineries, for instance. I mean, they're selling black market oil. They're getting millions of dollars a day. I don't want ISIS getting money. I mean, in the past, we've played roles we invented the concept of peacekeepers. That has involved troops in areas that are dangerous, like Korea. That has involved fatalities on the battlefield. But I look at the situation in Syria, the refugee camps right now that are overloading, it's a humanitarian crisis of refugee camps in Jordan, in Turkey, in Lebanon, and the risk to aid workers of being kidnapped by ISIS. It seems to me that there's a role potentially to be played by Canadian military providing protection for those refugee camps, protection for aid workers. And in those kinds of situations, of course, they could escalate. If someone fires on Canadian troops who are providing protection for aid workers, they'd have to fire back. So it's not that that Greens are saying that there's no way we'd want to see action against ISIS. We would, but it would have to be more effective than what Stephen Harper has proposed, and not an action that is solely based on what I think is unlikely to succeed, particularly on a short-term mission. These are long-haul missions in which we ought to figure out what's the most effective way to take on ISIS. Stopping the flow of money and stopping the flow of weapons and restoring good relations with governments in the region that share common cause to get rid of these criminal organizations is something that through diplomacy we're not doing nearly enough. We're not looking at routes through diplomatic means to build the case of working with regional governments. It's primarily a regional problem. We should be working with those governments that are most threatened by these criminal organizations and helping them.
Switching topics entirely on sort of the fiscal policy and the budget, the government has proposed to do a few things in terms of taxes. One is introduce income splitting. The other is increase the children's fitness tax credit, and the other is increase the universal child care benefit. Would you keep any of those three policies? Would you adjust any of them? Would you scrap any of them?
We're going through that process now, and I'm not trying to duck it. We've, as a party, had once thought income splitting would be acceptable, but we had been funding it through a carbon tax. We've now, the membership has changed our carbon tax policy to fee and dividend, which actually is an improvement. It makes it completely revenue neutral, and the dividend is returned to every single Canadian as a check based on the per capita share of every Canadian over 18 to their share of every penny collected in a carbon fee. So operationally for us, we have to, once we see Joe Oliver's budget, we have to figure out how much of his budget can, because we actually do a budgeting exercise where we publish with our platform, and we've done this the last several elections, ever since I've been leader, 3 years out with detail, where we cost our programs, how we pay for them, and as a party that believes in balanced budgets, except, you know, in an extreme case such as occurred in 08, we supported a stimulus package then. But we think it's important to also pay attention to Canada's debt, which is now at over $600 billion, 24% of it added under Stephen Harper. In principle, you know, I think that the direct child support benefits are more defensible if we can figure out how to make sure we afford them. But the Greens also have our own child care plans, which would involve child care spaces for people who choose to want to work earlier in their kids' early education period. And we favor for early child care the creation of workplace spaces in partnership with employers. So it's a different model, and I need to crunch through all the numbers.
Would you balance the budget this year?
Well, that depends on where Joe Oliver's budget ends up. I don't think that it made any sense to postpone the budget based on the price of oil. Let me say that first of all. The oil sands are 2% of our GDP. The amount of tax taken in by the entire fossil fuel sector in Canada is not that big an impact that you can't deal with it through the contingency fund. So I think their problem was not fiscal but political. They promised so many things, such as the ones you listed, and they made the political commitment that they would do this in a balanced budget. So they've basically painted themselves in a political corner. But as a matter of fiscal difficulties, I think they should have brought out a budget at exactly when Canadians expect their budget. In terms of where Greens will end up, we will shoot to have a balanced budget, but I don't know how large a hole Stephen Harper will have dug for us by then. And we also want to make sure that we're prudently budgeting 3 years into the future, and we need a lot more money for infrastructure. So I can tell you one thing the Greens will do is increase taxes on the largest and most profitable corporations. They're currently paying half the tax rate in Canada that they pay in the United States. We're going to have to adjust the revenue side because it's clear that municipalities need more funding and urgently for the other really pressing deficit, which is the infrastructure deficit, and we need to get on that very quickly.
That was Green Party leader Elizabeth May discussing her party's chances in the next election, the mission against ISIS, and income splitting.
Still to come, the Maclean's panel weighs in on the latest developments in the misconduct allegations against two MPs, and we discuss the latest on the investigation into the actions of RCMP and Parliament Hill Security during the Ottawa terror attack. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
Hi, it's time for the panel. I'm John Geddes of Maclean's Magazine with my colleague Aaron Wary, also of Maclean's, Cormac McSweeney from Rogers Radio and City TV. Cormac, I'm sitting in your chair this week because I wanted a chance to ask you about the exclusive story you had today on the OPP investigation into the October 22nd shootings on Parliament Hill. What did you learn, and what does it tell us about what's going to happen next?
Well, a bulk of the investigation has actually wrapped up. OPP investigators are done questioning witnesses, examining all of the evidence that they collected at the scene, and now they're actually currently drafting the final report, which will be sent to the Speaker of the House of Commons as well as the RCMP Commissioner. Now, these investigations are actually standard. Anytime you have an officer involved shooting, it's just that the RCMP and Parliament Hill Security don't have a provincial review body to look over this stuff, so they ask the OPP to come in and investigate. So it is moving along right now, and we should have the final report sent to the Commissioner and the Speaker of the House of Commons in the very near future.
Does that mean we're all going to see it, or what do you think?
Well, it's unclear about how the public rollout will happen, because once it's given to those two bodies, it's up to them to make it public. The OPP has no say in the matter after that point. So I imagine that the Speaker's office and the government will look over this report as well as the RCMP. They're going to make sure that certain things are not made public, such as possibly security on the Hill, maybe footage from the security cameras, because that's part of the reasoning why they didn't actually release that footage in the first place, because they don't want to let people know where where their security cameras are placed within Parliament Hill. The RCMP also has its ongoing investigation right now into what led to the attack with Michael Sahaf-Mabo, and so they're going to make sure that nothing sort of conflicts with their investigation, I imagine, as well. Sure. So a lot they have to go over, but it should answer a lot of lingering questions that the public has about what exactly happened in that final
intense
gun battle.
Intense public interest in that, right? I mean,
definitely.
A lot of it is just human interest, right? We want to kind of know what happened.
How many shots were fired? How many times Michael Sahaf-Mabo was actually hit? Did Parliament Hill Security and RCMP follow all the proper protocols in dealing with a situation like that? And remember, this is not just what happened in that final gun battle. This is from the moment he stepped foot on Parliament Hill, his run up to those front doors, his hijacking of the minister's car, and then his run through the Hall of Honor to the point where he did have that final gun battle. And there has been some controversy about who fired that final shot.
Yeah.
You know, some people are saying it's Sergeant-at-Arms, former Sergeant-at-Arms, Kevin Vickers. There are other narratives out there. It could have been an RCMP officer. Who really knows until we actually get that definitive answer? Or we may never know for sure because, you know, a lot of shots were fired. So
at least as interesting as the video that Sahaf-Mabo himself shot, the cell phone video that we saw a couple weeks ago. I mean, these pieces, as they come in, are... It's just such a natural human, kind of Canadian public interest in all this stuff.
Yeah, and we'll have to wait and see what the RCMP digs up as well to see who else may have been involved, if there are others involved in the lead up to this attack. So it's just another big piece in what is a big puzzle about what happened that day.
Sticking with stuff going on Parliament Hill, about you know, the life and lore of the Hill, there was this messy situation with a couple of Liberal MPs and allegations of sexual harassment. Aaron, fill us in on what happened here this week on that, and is there a next stage that we should be watching for?
So this week, the Liberals, I guess, accepted the report from the independent investigator.
Their own independent investigator.
And both MPs, Mr. Pichetti and Mr. Andrews, basically said they won't run for the Liberals again. I kind of feel like this was the predictable end to this. I from the point when they announced, Mr. Trudeau announced that these two MPs were being kicked out of caucus or suspended from caucus, it kind of seemed like it would be a hard thing to figure out how to explain how they would ever get back into caucus, right, ever be allowed to run as Liberals again. I think it probably seems like a slightly unsatisfactory ending. We're never going to see this report. It's going to be kept confidential. Mr. Andrews and Mr. Pichetti aren't exactly, you know, discussing the allegations against them. The two NDP MPs aren't talking. I guess to a certain degree, it would be nice to know exactly what happened here and you know, get some sort of closure to the whole thing. But I suspect that also was not going to come. You know, these were personal events that became public, and to a certain degree, they're now going to be kind of personal again.
To me, the interesting part of that public-personal or public-private aspect is that Cynthia Peterson, the lawyer the Liberals brought in to study this whole thing, the reason she's an expert on this is because she normally does this kind of thing for the Law Society of Upper Canada, for cases involving lawyers in law firms or other places where lawyers work. And my understanding is their whole modus operandi is to keep it all quiet. These are cases where people don't want to bring charges, they don't want to be public. So all her work normally goes on without any glare, but the victims, the people who are accused with having done things, they don't see their names in public. In this case, to me, it's an awkward hybrid. We have the names public, but the details and the findings private. Surely that can't be allowed to happen every time there's something like this.
Yeah, right? I mean, the one thing that you would hope would move forward from this is that there would be some process designed to deal with these situations in the future. Yeah. You know, you can't have a situation in which, you know, MPs necessarily have to step forward and deal with these things publicly. You know, you can't have MPs standing up in the House of Commons, or you can't expect that MPs who feel they've been wronged,
right,
standing up in the House of Commons and launching questions of privilege against, yeah, each other. There has to be some kind of mechanism for dealing with these things. I suspect that no one is particularly happy with the way this has worked out.
But surely at least
there's got to be a new process.
At least it
forward.
Nudges them in a direction. And Cormac, they could have a person like Cynthia Peterson available all the time. You know?
They could use this as an example to move forward with the Board of Internal Economy when these things do arise. I think that that this issue is not going to go away anytime soon, like both parties hope for, because both parties put out a statement saying, in their eyes, this is now done.
Right.
But, you know, we're going to be talking about harassment policies moving forward to see how everything changes in the wake of all of this. And the other thing to keep in mind is that Scott Andrews hasn't counted himself in or out for the next election.
Yes.
And I think if he decides to run as an independent against the Liberals or whoever else is going to try and take him on in that riding of Avalon, then this is going to be hanging over that race. And on Election Day, for sure, one of the big ridings you're going to keep an eye on is going to be this one to see what happens with it.
That is really interesting. Can we flash forward a little bit to the coming week? It would be a busy week. The House has been off this week, so there's always a bit of pent-up business and stuff coming. But I guess the biggest thing we know about is that the government's going to table a motion to extend the military mission in Iraq. Who wants to start? What are we watching for there, Aaron?
I think we're watching to see exactly what they want to do, obviously, and how far and in what way they want to extend and expand this mission. I think then, not to take this out in purely into politics, but then I think the question
becomes... Let's take it down.
Let's just get right out of the principle and the policy. What do the Liberals do now? Mm-hmm. They voted against the last motion on this mission. They got a lot of criticism for that. Justin Trudeau made his unfortunate penis joke. It did not go well. It was not his finest hour. How do they handle this now? Can they possibly support the mission now? Can they possibly support an extension, mm-hmm. having not supported it a few months ago? And on the other hand, if they oppose it again, do they end up having to answer the exact same question?
Compound the problem.
How can you possibly not want to oppose the Islamic State?
What do you think, Cormac?
Well, I agree with Aaron. It's going to be very tough for the Liberals to see where they go on this. I mean, the NDP is also saying we want to see the motion before we decide what to do, but they've been opposed from this from the start on this issue. I think the government has already started to just give those hints that they classically do in the lead up to what their decision will be so that they can soften the public to their stance on this. From the interview we heard earlier in the show with James Bazin, he talked about how he's happy with the way the advise and assist role has gone, and they're content with that. So it doesn't appear like they may be heading towards a combat role in terms of expanding the mission. Syria is something that he talked about quite a bit. I mean, to the point where he was coming out right away and saying, listen, we're not supporting the Assad regime. We're not working with the Assad regime. I just want to make that clear. Sort of tells you that that could be somewhere where they're going, and they're leaving that option open. It was there in the original motion, but you had to kind of deal and get the approval of the government in Syria to deal with that, and that is the Assad regime. And I find it interesting that Bazin was sort of hinting that they may go around the government and use their allies to get that approval from the Syrian
government.
I don't
know what they're going to do in that Syria question. It's so dicey, but I will say when I spoke with Jason Kenney a couple of weeks ago on various things, he would not rule out some kind of opening to be active in Syria. So I guess that'll be part of the debate this coming week.
And that's where, if I had to guess, that's where I would suspect the Liberals maybe find their out, is by saying we are steadfast against bombing in Syria.
So we can't
can't support the mission.
And also that's a very difficult situation to jump into. If you start getting into Syria with the civil war they have going on there right now, and ISIS probably using guerrilla tactics to make sure that it's in with innocent people and using the cover of innocent people in Syria, it's going to be very difficult to fight that properly.
Difficult all over that region. Thanks, you guys. Great panel.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.